Case number SCWC-29742, Alakai Nakeiki, Inc. v. Matayoshi. Arguing for the petitioner, Perry Confalone. Arguing for the respondent, Deirdre Marie Iha. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed today? Okay, Mr. Confalone, my understanding is you're going to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a yellow light. We'll come on with 10 minutes to go in your argument, just to let you know you're getting there. And Ms. Marie Iha, you've had 5 minutes before the end of your argument. You'll get a warning. Very well. If you'd proceed, Mr. Confalone. Thank you.
May it please the court. The central issue in this appeal is whether a statute that empowers the head of an administrative agency with exclusive, final, and conclusive authority to interpret the law, interpret the regulations, and finally adjudicate the rights of a petitioner as to whether or not that petitioner may or may not contract with the state, and finally adjudicate whether her agency in fact acted lawfully, whether that statute is repugnant to Article 6, Section 1, of the Hawaii Constitution. An underlying issue I think that the court may address is whether the court, consistent with existing doctrines of statutory construction, can properly avoid the constitutional issue in this case by reading the statute so as to permit judicial review. And the third substantive issue in this case is whether the Intermediate Court of Appeals erred by dismissing Alakai Nakeiki's tort claim against the Department of Education, where it was based on an exclusivity of remedies provision in Chapter 103F that should be deemed unconstitutional and therefore void. Article 6.
Counsel, can you read this statute to allow judicial review?
Your Honor, I think it's problematic, and I think our position would be the court could not properly do that consistent with existing doctrine. And the reason why I say that is that the court has long followed the doctrine that a court's primary obligation in interpreting a statute is to discern legislative intent. And the primary method for discerning legislative intent is by the words of the, examine the words of the statute. And unless the words of the statute are unambiguous.
There's a lot of federal precedent that says the words final and conclusive doesn't mean that judicial review is precluded.
Yes, Your Honor. We cited, I think there was the...
So if you cited that, then doesn't that support the idea that the statute could be construed, because it only uses the term final and conclusive, as allowing judicial review?
We cited that, Your Honor, as essentially a secondary theory of recovery. When I reviewed the decisional law, I think the court could attempt to do that, and I think the court could rely on federal precedent, such as, I think it's the Lindahl decision, where you had a statute that said final and conclusive. And the court said that, well, we could read that just as easily to mean final and conclusive as to findings of fact.
Well, there's nothing explicit in the statute that says no judicial review, correct?
In 103A.
Yeah.
Your Honor, I think, for example, irrespective of what the statute said, there would be judicial review of the constitutionality of the statute.
Well, my question is, the plain language of the statute doesn't explicitly preclude judicial review other than by the language final and conclusive, or final and conclusive, is that it, or the exclusive means available?
Yes, Your Honor, the statute does not say there shall be no judicial review. The statute says the determination of a request for reconsideration by the head of the contracting agency shall be final and shall be conclusive. And the statute further provides, however, that the remedies provided herein are the exclusive remedies for...
exclusive remedies in terms of resolving, I think, the statute says resolving the concerns of the parties.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it doesn't preclude a claim being made.
Your Honor,
I guess what I'm saying, you know, is that you have a secondary theory. Your primary theory would require this court to rule that a statute is unconstitutional, which presents a formidable barrier. So is that your only position, that we would have to declare this statute unconstitutional?
Your Honor, our key position is that this statute is unconstitutional. It is the court, in our view, we have advanced a theory that the court could invoke the federal doctrines. I think, Your Honor, to this court, it would be engaging in a legal fiction, because if one were to
If we hold the statute is constitutional, you lose.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think there's no way this court can properly uphold the constitutionality of the statute.
And are you then suggesting that if we find the procedures called for in the statute unconstitutional, then those procedural remedies are unconstitutional, therefore unenforceable? And so, therefore, there is no administrative review?
Your Honor, I think the outcome of that would be that the court, using its powers, would need to construct some form of interim remedy that would permit judicial review while the legislature fixed this law. And if I may...
I'm not sure how you're helping your client if you cite federal precedent that says final and conclusive doesn't mean that precludes judicial review, and then take the position that the only way this can be resolved would be to declare the statute unconstitutional.
What I wish to point out to the court is that this court, we have cited federal precedent to permit judicial review notwithstanding this language. What I wish to point out to the court is, for in order for the court to do that, the court would need to look at the word final and as defined by the dictionary, not to be altered or undone, or relating to a concluding court action or proceeding, conclusive, which means putting an end to debate or question, and exclusive, which means the only remedy is. And the court would need to navigate that. And I think the more appropriate course of action, and finally, Your Honor, if one...
That's a great argument for the state.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because our key argument is this statute...
That's the argument they make.
Excuse me?
That's the argument they make. It's final and conclusive. That's the end of it.
Yeah.
That's the argument you're making now.
The argument I'm making, Your Honor, it's final and conclusive and it's unconstitutional.
Are you suggesting that the entire procedural remedy is unconstitutional or only that provision? Only the part that says final and conclusive?
That provision. And I think, Your Honor, when one looks at the legislative intent here, which was clearly to create a streamlined mechanism for dealing with these contracts in order to expedite the services, human services, to people in need, it did not mean that there would be some type of additional court process that people would be required to go to, such as an extraordinary writ of mandamus or declaratory judgment action with discovery and appeals and things of that sort. So to me, Your Honor, the difficulties posed by following the federal law is that it seems to counter what the legislature intended here.
Is there anything at all in the legislative history that even addresses the subject of judicial review explicitly?
No, Your Honor.
And there's a statement of findings that went along with the enactment of Chapter 103D, in which the legislature made certain findings. Did it include a finding that it intended to preclude judicial review?
A 103D or 103F?
I'm sorry, 103F, pardon.
Your Honor, we've looked at the legislative history. The only legislative history that seems pertinent is the legislative history cited by the Intermediate Court of Appeals, which says they wanted a streamlined approach. So that is the conundrum, Your Honor.
What about what the legislature says, I think more than once, that the system was intended to promote fair and equitable treatment of those who apply for these contracts and for those who are paid under these contracts? Wouldn't that mean, I mean, I'm not clear about who, you know, what your position is, because if you're talking about fair and equitable treatment for your client, doesn't that mean that they should have the ability to have the decision of the DOE subject to judicial review?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you can construe this statute then as allowing judicial review?
Your Honor, following federal precedent, I can see how that would be permitted. As an officer of the court, I see there's difficulties here. If one were to abide by the tenets of statutory construction that have been followed by this court for decades.
Well, let's look at it in another way. If we go the way you're suggesting, then the statute precludes judicial review, and your suggestion is we should invalidate that under the Constitution.
Yes,
correct?
Your Honor.
Okay. If we were to invalidate that under the Constitution, what would be the limiting principle that you would offer in terms of how would this court be able to, going forward, know what categories of disputes would be able to come to this court under Article 6, Section 1? I mean, it literally any dispute someone has with an action by a state agency, where the state agency took made some kind of a decision adverse to them, would literally every one of the countless decisions that are made by state government and county government every day be potentially brought to the court, or would there be some limiting principle? And if so, what would that limiting principle be?
Your Honor, as I read the decisions, where a state agency purports to interpret the law and determine the rights and responsibilities of petitioners and respondents, the legal rights and responsibilities of petitioners and respondents, that is permissible under the modern view of administrative law as long as there is some form of judicial review.
If I might interrupt, Mr. Confalone, don't we have a presumption in this jurisdiction that the legislature intended judicial review of administrative decisions?
Yes,
the
Your
HGEA
Honor.
Case?
I'm familiar with that case, Your Honor. And I imagine the analysis would be, does the expressed words of the statute overcome that presumption? And the problem that we see analytically is you have the words final, you have the words conclusive, you have the words exclusive authority. You read Chapter 103F in conjunction with 103D and pari materia, and you know that when the legislature wants to create judicial review, it certainly knows how to do it. And you know the overall legislative intent was to create a streamlined process for the determination of these rights. So the difficulty is squaring the language of the statute and determining whether or not that presumption is met or overcome. And that, I think, analytically is a problem presented by the court to the court. We have advanced the theory that the court had inherent powers pursuant to the Leadham v. Kine line of cases. We are stating that the better outcome that is more consistent with the principles articulated by this court is to face the constitutional question head on. A related issue is, what is the burden here? Is it that the statute is presumed?
How would the court exercise its inherent power? I mean, would we have to construct a whole new procedure to accommodate clients that you represent?
The problem, Your Honor, that is part of the problem, because one would have to resort to what we had to do. First, we tried to get administrative review through the Administrative Procedure Act. That failed. Then we brought a declaratory judgment action. That failed. Possibly there's some type of writ of mandamus that would allow a disappointed petitioners to have access to the courts when things happen to them, like what happened here. So it's difficult, and that's what makes it a problem.
So then shouldn't you go to the legislature to erect that kind of procedure? Because we're not in the business of setting out procedures for you to follow or for the state to follow in terms of processing these bids.
Your Honor, that is why the better outcome here is to face the statute and declare it for what it is. Is an unconstitutional delegation of judicial power.
Okay, and then that's my question again. If we do that in this case, what's going to limit it just to this context? What would the principled way to be to say no to the thousands of other people who may have disagreements with some action by state government? Or would literally anyone who's dissatisfied with an action by a state official and can invoke a state statute or rule and suggest that the official in some way is violating that rule have a direct right of action under the Constitution?
Your Honor, my understanding, reading the decisions that articulate the principle of check that we have set forth in the petition for certiorari, those courts address what judicial power means, and judicial power comes into play when an agency has a statutory or regulatory regime in place to determine the rights and responsibilities and liabilities of petitioners and the agency. And when those things are in place, there needs to be some way of judicial review in order to determine whether or not this agency correctly applied the law.
So if the procurement codes were taken off the books and the agency just followed whatever its own thought of good policy was in issuing contracts, wouldn't be a problem?
Your Honor,
no review.
I think, Your Honor, if the agency, if there was a political determination that they were going to take these types of contracts off the books and contract at will, so to speak, and to whoever who held the signs during the election campaigns and that things of that sort, that would be a political question. But I would also submit to the court, if those contracts were let fraudulently or otherwise unlawfully, there would still be recourse to the courts for that kind of activity.
Mr. Confalone, if I may ask you, if the court invalidated the statute as unconstitutional as you request, your client then, are you saying that the whole procurement process would have to be started over again, or would your client just be allowed judicial review of the last departmental decision?
Our client would be allowed, first of all, the statute would be declared unconstitutional. We have a tort claim pending in this case, which was dismissed pursuant to the exclusivity of remedies provision, which we feel is unconstitutional. Our client would be permitted to get a court determination as to whether this agency acted negligently, fraudulently, in terms of the way it scored its proposal and in terms of the way it administered the protest.
Would the remedy change if we decided that the statute was constitutional but allowed for judicial review?
I think, Your Honor, it would be up to the court to determine if the court exercised inherent power to review what happened below. The court would be in the position it was in, I think, in the Carl decision, would have had to fashion some type of remedy for the wrongdoing that occurred below, and the remedy there was attorney's fee award in the Carl 1 decision.
Are you, the way you state the question on the application, assuming 103F is unconstitutional, did the ICA err in affirming dismissal of ANK's tort claim? And are you conceding that if this court deems the statute constitutional, your tort claim is also, the ICA did not err in holding that there is no affirming the circuit court's action with respect to the tort claim, based on no private right of action?
Sure. As I understand the court's question,
yes.
If the court determined that this was constitutional, presumably because there's some access to the courts,
yes.
Would that in fact mean that the ICA was correct in dismissing the tort claim? And Your Honor, I'm not willing to concede that, because the first problem I have with that premise is the court would have to say that exclusivity in the statute doesn't really mean exclusivity. And exclusivity was the reason why we were denied access to the courts for the tort claim. So the court would have to say, no, it's constitutional because final doesn't really mean final, conclusive doesn't mean conclusive, exclusivity doesn't really mean exclusivity.
And well, the federal courts have said that.
Yes, Your Honor. It has
so
said
that. Why? And a lot of state courts, you cite the case having to do with check.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so even state courts, I think, are even stronger in their belief that judicial review should, if at all possible, exist.
Your Honor, for example, the seminal case, as I see it, is McHugh, the Santa Monica Rent Control. That case permitted judicial review. The issue was whether or not issuance of penalties invaded the province of the judiciary. And a subsequent California decision where the statute permitted a renter to withhold rent upon a finding that the renter, that the landlord exceeded rent control. That invaded the judicial province because it was a penalty. And what the court said in footnote 44 was, we're directing the agency to stay its holding so that there may be judicial review pursuant to a statute in California that permitted mandamus actions in administrative cases. So all of the cases that we've cited, the courts, all of the cases we've cited permit judicial review. And that's, and all the cases we've cited in that petition say the judicial review is a necessary.
Do they declare the statutes unconstitutional?
No, because they permitted judicial review. But in one case, they declared that an aspect of the statute was unconstitutional because it permitted successful tenants to withhold rent that was due because that constituted essentially a judgment. And it directed the agency, stay your judgments on this, to give petitioners an ample opportunity to apply to the courts for review. So the state court approach to this, Your Honor, have uniformly, as far as I can see, said that there needs to be judicial review. In all of the provisions, such as the creation of workers' comp statutes, the creation of rent control boards, certain licensing statutes, all of them provided for judicial review expressly in the law. And they dealt with other aspects of judicial power, such as the power to enforce penalties and judgments. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Confalo. Ms. Marie Iha.
Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Associate Justices, good morning. May it please the Court, Deputy Solicitor General Deirdre Marie Iha, appearing on behalf of Catherine Matayoshi, respondent. I'm going to focus my comments on the questions that Your Honors have asked.
Before you get to that, sorry.
Certainly.
Is there a private analog to the interpretation and application of statutes and rules under the State Tort Liability Act that would apply to this case?
Your Honor, I believe there is not. This Court's holding in Kaohanohano versus DHS says that the state remains immune for liability based on governmental functions for which no private analog exists. And in our brief, we provided an on-point case from the Second Circuit, Chen versus the United States, which had to do with a contractor who attempted to sue under the Federal Tort Claims Act.
So would that take care of or be relevant to the claim for damages filed by the petitioner?
It certainly would, Your Honor. But I want to say first, I think you would first have to logically determine that there was a private right of action. You don't even need to reach the question of whether there's a waiver. But in order for plaintiffs to recover damages, they would have to have both a private right of action and a waiver. So I think if you find that there is no private right of action, and respectfully we believe that there is not, the primary test is legislative intent under the Reliable Collection Agency and Reese tests. And I think the legislator's intent that the remedies provided in 103F be exclusive is quite clear. And so with that, there is no private right of action. Once you reach that result, the question of the waiver under the State Tort Liability Act is superfluous, essentially, at that point. If I could turn to the constitutional questions, I wanted to focus on some of the questions Your Honors has asked. Chief Justice Rechtenwald inquired about a limiting principle. That is our primary concern, Your Honor. It is a precedent of this court under Sherman versus Sawyer that the legislature determines the jurisdiction of the courts. They do so by statutes, the statutes that we're all very familiar with. And Article 6, Section 1 provides that the original and appellate jurisdiction of the courts is as provided by law. When that provision was added into the Constitution in 1950, the delegates to the 1950 CONCON held in a standing committee report that the jurisdiction of the courts is left to the legislature.
So could the legislature enact a statute that would provide that all civil matters in the state of Hawaii going forward will be handled by a system of administrative tribunals with no review by the judiciary?
I think that would probably be going too far, because there is also a limiting principle on the legislature's authority, primarily, I would say, constitutional.
And that would be from Article 6, Section 1, that the judicial authority is vested in the courts.
Right. I mean, each one of the words in Article 6, Section 1 has a whole ream of case law attached to it. But essentially,
if that's too far, taking everything out is too far, in your view, doing what the legislature did here is okay. Where do we draw the line in the middle? How would we find the line?
I think we draw the line where the Constitution draws it and where this court's Chapter 91 jurisdiction has drawn it with due process. So if plaintiffs had a due process right to a hearing, they would have already had one under Chapter 91 jurisdiction. So I note in looking at the cases, the out-of-state cases that plaintiffs rely on, when I looked at those, I saw situations in which Hawaii law would have already addressed that problem. They have situations that are raising clear due process implications with rights and privileges to which our law would unquestionably give them a hearing under Chapter 91. So where these courts have chosen to address the question as a matter of judicial review under essentially an amorphous separation of powers argument, our law has already addressed those concerns under
Did the agency in this case, by interpreting the law or the rules and applying it and then deciding who prevails in a dispute as to how what the rules mean and how they should be applied, was that exercising what we normally think would be judicial power?
I think it's probably best described as adjudicatory or quasi-judicial, Your Honor. The modern world of the administrative state acknowledges that agencies can exercise executive authority, quasi-legislative, for example, when they issue regulations, which look more like statutes than anything else, and also adjudicatory authority. And the agencies can indeed exercise that.
How fair and equitable is that, that one party to the dispute decides what the outcome should be?
It's for the legislature to decide how much process to give in the absence of a constitutional requirement. So if plaintiffs can show no due process entitlement to more process than has been given by the legislature, then it's the legislature's determination as a matter of policy. And the court's decision in Carl 2, there was no review at all. Once they pulled
that. So if you agree that if the court thinks that's not enough process, because on the face of it, it doesn't look fair and equitable if one party to a dispute has a binding and final decision as to what the outcome should be, then shouldn't that result in there being judicial review?
No, Your Honor. The court has already gotten somewhat at those questions in Sifa Galoa and Peruca versus Cronin. In those two cases, there were questions, particularly in Peruca.
Sifa Galoa, there was judicial review in the statute.
Right, but you're getting at your question. Your question is about the same agency exercising, making the decision.
Right, but my question pertains, to this case where there is no judicial review.
Correct, Your Honor, but your question about whether it's fair and equitable for an agency to make the same decision has been answered in Peruca.
Then I qualify, because I'm talking about this case
where
there is no judicial review and one party to the dispute decides what the outcome should be.
Correct. It is not improper, because I think you're reading the Department of Education as if it was all one person. It was not the same person. There was people who worked on the procurement and people who did not. Worked on the procurement itself, who set up the request for proposals. And you cannot.
The other case you cited was which case?
Peruca versus Cronin and Sifa Galoa?
Okay. In the other case, was there judicial review?
Peruca versus Cronin, Your Honor, honestly, I do not recall. But I do remember that the way that it was set up with their hearing, that case was about minor parties getting on the ballot. And the Office of Election internally decided, no can do, you don't have enough signatures.
And that was judicially reviewed by the trial court.
It was, yes. So yes, then, Your Honor, it would have been judicially reviewed. But the internal review by the agency was by the chief election officer, the head of the same agency that made the initial determination. So you see, it was the same situation as
But the difference is that, for example, 103D does allow some sort of review through 91. But let me ask you this. In Sandy Beach Defense Fund versus City and County of Honolulu, didn't this court discuss that among the basic principles that hold administrative action to the rule of law are the following? One, government must practice fairness in its dealings with a citizen. And two, an administrative agency does not have the last word on any action taken by it. And then, this court went on to state that obviously the decision maker cannot have the last word on whether his decision is consistent with the statute that authorized him to act and whether there was fairness in the procedures he followed. The supremacy of law demands that there be an opportunity to have some court decide whether an erroneous rule of law was applied and whether the proceeding in which facts were adjudicated was conducted regularly.
Your Honor, I have not reviewed Sandy Beach recently, but based on what you've just read, I think due process, again, is your answer. Nobody has a legitimate claim of entitlement to a state contract. And I believe, I forget who inquired, but if the state was to elect to just give contracts as it was required, there would be no violation of the Constitution in doing so. And so by electing to provide the procedure does not create a due process right where there is none.
This court in that case stated, when courts have to deal with applicability of procedural due process to administrative agencies, they base their answer upon the distinction between legislative and judicial powers. And if adjudication is involved, the courts have a ready analogy in the judicial process.
Well, correct, Your Honor, but the Chapter 91 case law, every time a circuit court or the ICA or this court decides that there is no Chapter 91 jurisdiction, then there is no judicial review unless another statute provides it. So it's not quite as foreign as it might appear to our
what
law.
Do you think that a court is prohibited from review under the 632-1, the declaratory judgment statute?
Prohibited from review, I would say both yes and no, depending on what question you're asking. As to get to the merits of the dispute regarding the scoring of Alakaina Keiki's proposal, yes, because a remedy is provided elsewhere in the state. As to a declaratory judgment about the constitutionality of the provisions from 103F we're discussing today, then no. It is our position consistently that the court has jurisdiction to resolve the question that you're discussing, whether the restrictions are constitutional. And I want to note, since there was so much discussion about the federal standards, they discussed the Lindell case. Lindell relies on a Supreme Court case called Block, which lays out the U.S. Supreme Court standard about when a particular statute will be read to preclude judicial review. I think it's helpful. Whether and to what extent a particular statute precludes judicial review is determined from its express language, but also the structure of the statutory scheme, its objectives, its legislative history, the nature of the administrative action involved. There is federal case law that has upheld bans on judicial review against separation of powers challenges. Probably the most, the closest I was able to find, and not a, you know, fairly close, I wasn't able to find anything directly on point about procurement, but close, is the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery versus Thompson, 279 Federal 3rd 447 from the Seventh Circuit, and Painter versus Shalala, 97 Federal 3rd 1351 from the Tenth Circuit. And both of those were about Medicaid reimbursement where judicial review was barred. So a provider who wanted to get judicial review, no jurisdiction. And they were upheld against a separation of powers challenge. So that is as close as that we have gotten. So have the federal courts held that final and conclusive can sometimes mean, you know, that something else? Yes, they have. But they have also held in these two cases that if you have the language that is clear, then judicial review can and is barred. And as far as I can tell, it's not exercised.
And in this case, is there any clear language that says judicial review is barred?
Well, I think there's more than one way for a statute to be unambiguous, Your Honor. So as we read it, saying final and conclusive, and just as importantly, the exclusive remedies.
Well, it says final and conclusive to resolve the concerns of the parties. I'm not sure exactly what that means. The concerns of the parties.
I think the final and conclusive.
I'm sorry, it says final and conclusive, but the exclusivity provision says.
Correct.
As to the concerns of the parties.
Right, but I think if the decision is final and conclusive, and if you compare, as Mr. Confalone indicated, you compare what is done in Chapter 103D, which is its closest analogy, where they provide for a form of judicial review. It's actually not under Chapter 91. It's explicitly under its own forms of judicial review laid out in Chapter 103D. So like I would say, I mean, you could say, well, it's not explicit enough because it doesn't say judicial review is barred.
Is the question of the award of contracts in this case now moot?
The contract itself has been moot for several years, Your Honor. The contracts expired, I think, in 2006. They were renewed for 1 year. in 2007. So any relief premise on this particular procurement is long since gone. Alakaina Keiki does have current contracts, similar kinds of contracts with the DOE, which are presently due to expire in July of this year, but they're subject to renewal. So in terms of a relief premise on the contract itself, I think that is definitely moot.
Can you imply a private right of action out of 103F?
I believe you cannot, Your Honor. The exclusivity provision and the exclusivity provision indicates that this is the only remedies available. Like I said, I mean, the fact that somebody else might have written it differently does not make it ambiguous. There's more than one way to be unambiguous. Under the recent reliable test, the legislative intent is the determinative factor. So I think the ICA correctly applied.
If we were to find it ambiguous and went to the legislative history, there's nothing in the legislative history to indicate that the legislature intended this result of precluding judicial review.
In 1997 itself, I believe that that's correct, Your Honor. But if you look a little bit deeper into the legislative history, sorry, give me a moment to find my. Originally, the procurement of services was governed by 42D, and the people were not pleased with how that was working out. So in 1996, the year before, the legislature passed a session law that planned initially to transfer these procurements to 103D, which does provide for judicial review. That session law was Act 310 from 1996. In that same session law, they request the State Procurement Office to prepare a report. How should these particular procurements be handled? The Procurement Office responded with a detailed report filed in 1996, and it recommended that these procurements not be done under 103D, but instead should be done under Chapter 103F, under a separate chapter, which then became 103F. Among those recommendations was the State Procurement Office's recommendation that there not be any judicial review. So I think the comparison between the two chapters then becomes drawn into stark relief. In 1997, the legislature followed that recommendation and enacted what is now Chapter 103F. So although you're correct, it doesn't say in the reports there's no judicial review. It does say it's a simpler, standardized process. And when you compare the...
Which is that? That's true of both 103D and 103F. It describes the whole process as a more simplified process.
Well, the legislative history for this statute concerns only 103F.
I know, but 103D says the same thing, the legislative history for 103D.
Correct, but our first source of legislative intent is the statute, of course. And
under the federal standard, there has to be clear and convincing evidence that the legislature intended to preclude judicial review.
Correct, Your Honor. Yeah. And I think that the statutes provide that because it says that the remedy is exclusive. I think in plain language, exclusive means...
It doesn't say remedy is exclusive, does it? It says...
In terms of the word remedy, I believe not. I think it says... Let me check the statute itself. Shall be the exclusive means available for persons aggrieved in connection with the award of a contract to resolve their concerns.
To resolve their concerns.
Correct. But I think, like I said, there's more than one way for that to be, to be unambiguous. And I don't think that we should be hyper-technical and require the legislature to use the word remedy
if you can
imply, says exclusive.
Private right of action under 103F, could you then proceed under the declaratory judgment statute?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. If you do imply a private right of action,
yes.
Could you proceed to declaratory judgment to do what? To raise a constitutional claim? Because I'm sorry.
To raise a claim with respect to whether the procedure followed by the agency was illegal.
I don't understand plaintiffs to be asking for that, respectfully, Your Honor. I understand their inquiry to be whether a private right of action to pursue
what do you
tort
think
of that? Negligence, to tort of negligence to pursue damages. So in doing so, their view of the facts is that the DOE did not properly review their proposal. So they're getting at the same question that you're asking, but coming at it from a different angle.
Right. Could you bring it under 632.1 or 6611?
Well, I still think 632.1 would not work. The declaratory judgment statute is meant to apply when there is no means provided by other statutes. to resolve the concerns. So if you read a private right of action into 103F, and of course we believe that that would not be consistent with the legislative intent, but if you did, then that would be stemming from 103F. It wouldn't be sort of free-floating, right?
There was, what about 6611?
I don't believe so. Plaintiffs did not raise 6611. The one that they seek to rely on is 603.21.9 on their interpretation of inherent powers, which we think is flatly inconsistent with case law, State versus Moriwake, interpreting that statute. There were several questions, Your Honor, about what would be the remedy? Where would this court go? Should they agree with plaintiff's argument? I think your questions get at how problematic that would be. For the court to direct that judicial review occur, and the plaintiffs ask in their opening brief that the courts determine the rules by which this would occur. I'm sort of puzzled about how that would actually occur. In order to do that, the court would have to decide which court or courts would review, the scope or deference of that review, the burden of proof, the composition of the record, the procedures, the deadlines, all of the things that we find in other sources. If you were to, answering those questions would be like deciding what process is due before deciding that the due process clause is triggered at all. And I think extended too far would infringe on the legislature's authority under Article 3, Section 1 and Article 6, Section 1. The other problem, which Justice McKenna, you asked about, is, well, if you strike the statutes down as unconstitutional, doesn't that give you no internal review? I think that's a possible interpretation, yes, and that had occurred to me. That would make this like Carl II. No review whatsoever. They would make their decision, and that would be the end of it. Just like in Carl II, where they decide that this particular procurement was exempt, that was the end of it. There was no review of that decision. So I question whether that is really, that would be an inflexible, rigid application of the separation of powers doctrine. This court in Visco versus Tanaka discussed how flexible that doctrine is. And it would effectively disallow the legislature from taking a middle road. A middle road that would allow an opportunity for a protester to bring their concerns to the agency, allow the opportunity for an agency to do a course correction if it was necessary, without delaying the provision of services or tying up a contract in lengthy and expensive litigation. And I think the kind of services at issue here, it's very important to understand.
This court said that agency is not qualified to adjudicate the propriety of its own action. And that's not anything novel, right? It said that more or less in other cases.
That is a correct quote from HOH Corp, Your Honor. However, the entire discussion, all of the paragraphs above and below that quote, are discussing the authority of an agency to resolve constitutional questions.
Well, the beginning of the sentence is, the administrative agency is not empowered to pass on the validity of the statute, which I guess goes to the constitutional issue,
right.
Nor is it qualified to adjudicate the propriety of its own action.
Right.
So the court saw that as two separate issues.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because a statute can be invalid, or a statute could be valid, but an action taken under it could be unconstitutional. And read in context, I firmly believe that the whole discussion in HOH Corp is not about whether an agency can determine whether its own actions are proper. The entire structure of administrative agencies puts a lot more authority for agencies to do exactly that than plaintiffs acknowledge. So I don't think that HOH Corp supports plaintiff's interpretation. I think that is misreading of how far that case extends. Your Honors, the procurements at issues here needs to be seamless. This particular contract at issue here was to service high-needs disabled children in the public schools. The services are complex. Sometimes it's not uncommon for a child to have services from multiple people. It's not an option for the contract to be delayed. It's not an option. The Department
now,
of
there's a provision that says, if the public interest is in danger or some kind of emergency, then the agency can set aside the normal procedures. So what we're talking about is a normal procedure, not a situation, because if it's not in the facts, that there's some kind of emergency that requires the agency to set aside what are the normal procedures.
Correct, Your Honor. 103F503 does provide for an exception for the award being suspended. But my discussion is not meant to discount the possibility that somebody could use that exception in 103F503, but to point out why these kinds of procurements are not handled under 103D. It is not, basically, if you were to set it up like we have here, where they resolved it, they didn't find, they resolved it against the protester, you're setting up the courts to resolve a moot question. The contract has long since expired. And there was, yes.
Is it your position that if the procuring officer in this case, or like the chief procurement officer, issued a decision which just on the face of it was utterly baseless, utterly inappropriate, reflected personal bias, I'm not saying that was the case here, but reflected personal bias against a particular bidder, that there'd be no right of review because that would not involve a due process issue?
I think the discussion in Sufagaloa and Peruca might somewhat get at that, saying that the general, there is no principle that the joinder of executive and judicial power is is improper unless there was a showing of bias. So I would hesitate to say that in the situation you've described, but it could not extend beyond the situation that we have here because there's no due process interest. So I think it would be constitutional for the legislature to just say you award the contract no review whatsoever. And the fact that they've elected to provide... Well,
clearly not if there were racial bias, or would you take the position
well, that would be
a racially biased decision, no review either?
No, that would be based on the Constitution. Again, it would be equal protection, right? So the thing
well,
is...
Well, if it were illegal, arbitrary, or outside of the scope of the authority of the agency, that would be a situation where the court should also take review.
Your Honor, I think it would depend on the existence of an independent constitutional right. There's a line from the New Jersey case that plaintiffs rely on, David, that kind of caught my eye. It says
due process would be a constitutional right.
Yes, of course, but plaintiffs have no due process interest here. This is procurement. No one has a legitimate claim of entitlement to a contract. That's the whole purpose of procurement, is that their unilateral expectation that the contract is theirs does not follow. The whole purpose of procurement is to give the other folks the opportunity to submit their proposals as well.
So if the chief procuring officer said, I'm not giving you this contract because you protested the last contract next time around. Not giving it to you, you protested it, you took us to court. I'm just not going to give it to you. I'm sick of you. Is that a problem? I'm not saying that would happen. I'm not saying
I think
that
in the circumstances
did happen. I'm just saying that's the case. No review or review.
I think the circumstances described might lead to an equal protection claim, Your Honor. Again, I would hinge it again on the Constitution. Plaintiffs do not claim they have a due process right. If they had claimed it, they would not have one. Okay, but they are not claiming. They are claiming that the separation of powers itself alone leads.
They say there was an unfair application of their criteria and glaring errors in terms of computation, etc. So if that were true, then they have no recourse, you're saying?
Well, they had recourse, Your Honor, the internal procedure.
Beyond the person, I mean, they're challenging the adjudicator's actions, so they would have no recourse as opposed to what the adjudicator said?
Well, meaning no judicial review of that decision, that is correct. And I think the reason that is fine under the Constitution is two things. First is, they have no constitutional right that entitles them to any more. If there's no constitutional right at issue, then it's up to the legislature to decide how much procedure is given.
Aren't they also challenging the fact that the motion for reconsideration was not considered by the superintendent as it was supposed to be, but was improperly delegated? So what if the procedures called for aren't even followed? There's no judicial review?
Your Honor, they did raise that issue below, and I think it's mentioned once in the opening brief, but as I recall, it is not in the cert application.
I understand, but yeah. I'm just saying there would be no judicial review, even if the procedures called for under the statute aren't even followed. There's no
Again, Your Honor,
review.
I would have to say, unless there is a freestanding constitutional right that entitles them to more process, that Article 6, Section 1 gives the legislature the authority to determine the jurisdiction of the courts. So if there was a constitutional issue, for example, what if there was a statute that said...
Would the judicial power have any meaning if it's the power as set forth in the Constitution would always be subject to the legislature's decision as to whether or not the courts would have
of
jurisdiction?
Course. Of course, Your Honor, because as we've said in the...
So you're saying that the legislature could eliminate all jurisdiction in the courts?
No. Not at all.
Okay, so then what kind of jurisdiction would have to be
that
preserved?
That is required by the Constitution. That's the answer, whether it's required by due process or equal protection or the criminal provisions for criminal. That is the limiting line. The legislature's authority to determine the jurisdiction of the courts is still limited by this court's authority to judge the constitutionality of that statute, like you are doing today. There are federal cases, in fact, that discuss exactly that, about the fact that the statute barring judicial review.
What about this principle of check that counsel spoke about?
Yes, Your Honor, the McHugh case. California has a different view of separation of powers than we do. So, first of all, I see their discussion as inconsistent with the more flexible doctrine adopted in this court, particularly Bisco versus Tanaka, I think is the most helpful one. McHugh and the other cases, only one of them, the New Mexico case, actually has a provision barring judicial review in it. So none of them actually decide whether the statute would be unconstitutional without it. The New Mexico case does have a provision that barred, but you see that due process again comes in, because that case was about a compulsory arbitration of an employment discharge. Nothing like this at all. And like I said before, I really do believe that this court's rulings on due process grounds in the Chapter 91 context has already addressed the situations that these other states. When I looked at the other cases, there was the Illinois case that had a city of Waukegan had the imposition of civil penalties for the violation of an environmental protection law, explicitly relying on adjudicating rights and revoking privileges. We have no civil penalties here. And there's nowhere near the same kind of invocation of due process. And under Hawaii law, by statute, a similar procedure would be subject to Chapter 91. So we don't have, none of the cases that they cite to are actually anything parallel to this, a procurement with no due process interest. So I do not see those state cases as extending all that far. The federal cases, like the two I cited earlier, and the federal standard, do uphold the possibility. Now, it's not, admittedly, it's not exercised very frequently, but Congress has done this and said that there's no judicial review. The fact that that statute is still subject to constitutional challenge, I think, is quite important. There's discussed by the D.C. Circuit, National Coalition to Save Our Mall versus Norton. I see my time is up. Thank you.
You can finish the thought.
Okay, finish the thought. Finish the citation. 269 Federal 3rd, 1092 from the D.C. Circuit. Your Honors, we ask you to uphold the decision of the ICA. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Confluent.
To begin with, Your Honor, the Chapter 103F, Section 504, exclusivity of remedies, says the procedures and remedies provided for in this part and the rules adopted by the Policy Board shall be the exclusive means available to persons aggrieved in connection with the award of a contract to resolve their concerns. I don't think that language remedies was mentioned by counsel. Secondly, Your Honor, with regard to the Superintendent of Education's abject failure to even abide by the rules governing requests for reconsideration, that most assuredly was set forth in our petition for certiorari. Thirdly,
is that a due process violation?
Your Honor, I would say that that can be, and some courts have recognized that as a due process violation within the context of the concept of check. That courts have equated the absolute inability to resort to the courts when one's legal rights have been adjudicated as a concept of due process. And that is in the city of Waukegan case cited in our cert petition in Illinois. Thirdly, Your Honor, with respect to the private analog issue, whether or not there's a private analog with respect to the Department of Education's conduct in the review of the proposal and the administration of the protest, the case before the ICA did not turn on that. I think it would be appropriate to remand where that can be briefed. But I would say for the record that in one particular case in Massachusetts, New England Insulation Company versus General Dynamics, 522 Northeast 2nd, 997, a case involving private contractors. A unsuccessful bidder successfully stated a claim against General Dynamics for its fraudulent practices with respect to a solicitation of bids. The theory of the case was General Dynamics was engaging in a fraud, a sham solicitation that inside it had favored contractors who was going to award the bid to anyway, and the Massachusetts Court of Appeals ruled against the motion to dismiss and ruled that that was a cognizable claim. I would be pleased to research this further and brief this below if the court remands. With respect to the private analog, with respect to the disposition of the protest, the findings of fact and the way the agency conducted itself, for example, assigning duties to people who didn't have authority to do so, violating their own rules, the private analog that comes to my mind is with respect to private arbitrators and the grounds for overruling arbitration decisions when arbitrators make errors in terms of failing to disclose conflicts of interest, engaging in fraud, engaging in collusion, or rendering opinions that are violative of public policy. The private analog would be those. There is judicial review of that kind of decision making.
In terms of government officials not following or not performing the duties called for under a statute, wouldn't mandamus be available?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think if the court were to determine that there is judicial review via mandamus, the problem that creates is that the uninitiated and people just trying to get their voices heard in the protest process are going to have to know that they're going to need to resort to these extraordinary writs, which are time-consuming and probably will protract the process even further. So I think that it does become a problem, Your Honor. With respect to due process, Your Honor, we tried to get review under the Administrative Procedure Act and it was declined review. I think what this comes down to, Your Honor, is an interpretation of Article 6, section, the second sentence. The ICA essentially said that because the legislature assigns jurisdiction to the courts, it can properly withhold jurisdiction to a court. But the ability to assign jurisdiction or withhold jurisdiction does not mean that the legislature can delegate judicial power to another branch of the government. And this is precisely what happened here. And people were hurt. Alakai and Katie lost 69 employees when we lost this case. Between 80 and 90% of its revenues when we lost this case, pursuant to a decision-making process that is a poster child for why we need judicial review, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take this matter.